You're listening to The Healthy Sensitive. Hello, and welcome back to The Healthy Sensitive. This is Leah, your hostess on the show. And wouldn't you know it, I was all gung-ho to be able to post more episodes more frequently. And as life has a tendency to do, it just went ahead and happened. So I lost someone really important to me, and the someone is not a human. I lost a beloved cat. Her name was Sasha. She almost made it to 16 years of age. She had been in my life from when I was 22 to now when I am 37. And I had known that it was coming. I could sense that she wasn't feeling well. I had taken her to the vet and wasn't getting a lot of answers, sort of a, well, we don't know what it is, but maybe it's an infection. Shrug. Here's some medication. Shrug. And she had been kind of rallying, her appetite had been improving, and so I decided to go on a weekend trip to visit friends. And wouldn't you know that that is the time that Sasha chose to pass. And I knew it was going to hurt, but I don't think I was prepared for how much. I had lost pets before, but it was always a little abstract. So the cat ran away, or the cat went missing. You know, I lived with my grandmother for a time, and she often had multiple cats, and she was on a property that had almost an acre of land. So it was not uncommon for a cat to just disappear, and presumably the coyotes got to the poor cat or something. So it's not like I was unprepared for the loss of a being, a fur baby. But Sasha was unique because Sasha was the first cat that I had had in my life from, well, basically from birth. My friend and I stumbled across her. We were on a hike. There were three of us. And there was myself. It was one of my closest friends and the guy I was dating at the time, who, by the way, happened to be allergic to cats. And as we heard a noise, it was actually my friend who heard the noise first. And in the context of, you know, she said, that sounds like a kitten. And I didn't even recognize it as a kitten call. It was so loud and piercing. We find this kitten who is clearly abandoned, either by mama, by a human. Again, it was on a hike. We were about half a mile up. So there was no sense that someone was going to come back for this poor little thing. So naturally, you know, we're cooing over this little creature. And the guy that I was dating at the time said, well, what should we do? Should we take her to the pound or dot, dot, dot? And then he sees the look on two women's faces of horror. Like, what? He said, or take her home and name her and love her. So that kind of reveals, yeah, he was high caliber dude. He, despite his allergy, he understood that this vulnerable creature would be invited into our lives permanently. So nursed her, had to bottle feed her because her eyes hadn't even changed color. She was such a little thing. And she was always a little bit wild. She was always a little bit cranky, always a little bit temperamental. And I really liked that about her because it almost made it more special that she would get on my lap, that she would curl up next to me and sleep with me. And in fact, a few years later, when I would be in the midst of a panic attack in the middle of the night, suffering from insomnia, one of the ways I would self-soothe would be to draw myself a bath. And I have a memory of Sasha coming up on the border of the bathtub and her just sitting there, looking at me, sort of like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing right now. Mom, weirdo. And she also, when one night I finally was asleep, and the guy I was dating at that time, also a very kind human, heard something. I was learning how to sleep with an eye mask and earbuds because we lived in the city at that time in San Francisco, and it was really, really loud. And so I, you know, anytime I did get to sleep, he was very protective of not wanting to wake me up unless it was absolutely necessary. And yet he heard a weird meow. We had two cats at the time, and it was a unique meow, one he hadn't heard before. Sasha wasn't typically very loud. She very rarely made noise. And he realized it was her meowing. So he gets up and starts poking around and realizes that there's a fire happening on the awning of our apartment building. As it happens, the fire department had already gotten there. They'd already taken care of it. But he looks down at this cat and basically tips his hat to her and says, you know, if that had not been taken care of, you would be responsible for having saved our lives. Bravo, madam. So again, a unique creature. She also managed to survive many moves. I don't even know how many. And my 20s. She survived a relationship with another guy who was yet again allergic to cats. And so we had to be very creative with how we constructed a place that all three of us could live in. She survived the welcoming of my dog. And you can imagine a grown cat at that point was not thrilled, but she dealt with it. So just a real trooper, that Kit Kat. And I know for some people who maybe don't have pets, this is a little, maybe not silly, but kind of a, all right, kid, really, this is your hard thing, a cat. But for those who do have pets, I was really amazed by how many people would come out of the woodwork to say, oh my God, I lost a cat. It was 7 years ago. I'm still sad. Or a dog, or a, you know, and someone said once, you know, the thing about fur babies is that it's so clean. It's so uncomplicated. You know, humans, we have complex stories and narratives that can create some ambivalence about our loss. But with fur babies, it's just pure, unadulterated love. And because this month was about meaning and purpose, I also thought it was interesting that the most recent episode that I did was on workaholism. I'll tell you, if there's one cure, at least for me, for workaholism, it's grief. It really slowed me down. I think it also, I don't want to say woke me up, that sounds a little bit pretentious, but tapped me on the shoulder in a very profound way. And it had me thinking quite a bit about, again, because this whole month I've been focusing quite a bit on this concept of meaning and your something larger and purpose. Might grief and meaning be interrelated? How might this be helpful for highly sensitive people in particular, but maybe just people in general? So, because I am me, naturally, I went into research mode and thought, what can I learn about grief? Well, first of all, grief has many flavors and forms, or not many, but more than one. And so this is coming from Brené Brown's research, there's acute grief, which is the grief we feel, I think, in the immediacy of a loss. It's when it's all-encompassing, it's taken over our whole, it's taken our attention. There's integrated grief, which is when I don't want to say we've come to terms with it or we've gone past it, because I don't think grief is necessarily, at least based on the research, it's not something we ever, quote, get past, but it's like we've integrated it. We've found a place for it. You know, this book is coming with us, so we found a spot on the bookshelf, that sort of thing. There's complicated grief, which is when something is hindering our ability to integrate it fully. That might happen if it's, well, it depends. There's different frames for it, but let's say it's a parent who has dementia, and so you are grieving the loss of the person you remember, and yet the person is still there in a sense, but it's not the same. So it's a complicated sort of grief. It's not done yet. It's not finished. You can't yet integrate it. doesn't have a place yet. And then there's a more recent construct that Brené Brown points to called disenfranchised grief. And this is the sort of grief that might come to pass when the grief we feel is not validated, maybe, by our community, or might not be understood by the larger community. The most poignant example that she gives is a sexual assault survivor who would grieve the loss of trust, the loss of sexual desire, the loss of a worldview, the loss of self-confidence, and that sort of thing. So grief comes in many flavors. And I don't know how many of us, but a lot of people know about this idea of the stages of grief. David Kessler is known to speak quite extensively on this, you know, the five stages of grief. But more interestingly, Kessler talked about this idea of a sixth stage of grief. And that sixth stage of grief is about finding meaning. He introduces the sixth stage to the traditional five stages, and it's after acceptance. And he suggests that discovering meaning in loss is crucial for healing. He believes that while we may never understand why loss occurs, we can find meaning in how we remember loved ones, how we choose to continue living, and how we integrate the lessons learned from grief into our lives. It's a concept that helps many of us process our grief more fully and find a way forward. This seems really important for highly sensitive people because, as I've mentioned before, sensitive people have something called vantage sensitivity. So sensitive folks seem to suffer more from hardship, which would mean that grief might hit a more sensitive person more acutely. But on the flip side, they benefit more from interventions and from positive environments. So if a highly sensitive person, like me, should lose something and be grieving, which is excruciatingly painful, by creating or reframing or having interventions around it, the value of having meaning wrapped around in and kind of creating meaning from the loss can propel someone like me or anyone, but highly sensitive people even more so, into this idea of post-traumatic growth. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But this led me into Thomas More's book, The Dark Night of the Soul. I was curious if maybe he had anything to say about grief. I'd read the book, I don't even remember how long ago, but I remembered, if there's any dark night of a soul, I imagine grief would be a part of it. And he writes that the dark night of the soul may have like a bardo quality to it. And bardo is mentioned in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it's this liminal period between the old life that we're leaving behind and rebirth. And according to them, you can engage in practices that might get you into this liminal state. And he writes, when you've lost someone close to you and friends try to comfort you in your grief, you know, but they don't, that what you are experiencing is beyond grief. You sense in your body and in the fullness of your emotions a great rupture in the world you've known, an irrevocable emptiness that is not just to be felt, but completely absorbed if you were to go on. A genuine dark night of the soul takes you to this crossroad, this bardo place where you have an opportunity, extremely hard won, to live in a different world. And then a little bit further, he writes, the implosion of grief can become an explosion of compassion. You may have to go through several stages of grief. There we are, tipping his hat back to those five stages. But one day, you may be able to sense all these emotions settling into place, changing into a new vision. Along the way, you may have to do some crazy things, because when the soul is touched at its very foundations, only a departure from the rational can restore it. Grief is complete only with a shift in being, in the way you live, think, and relate to the world. All of this, don't worry, it's not only about my cat. What I appreciated about what Thomas More had to say about grief is that he's pointing to something that is beyond just the loss of the being, in this case, my cat, but also the loss of the life we are used to. It reminded me of the loss of my stepdad. I called him Pop. He died of lung cancer when I was in college. I had the privilege of being able to take a quarter off of college and come home. And I would like to say, and, you know, maybe fluff my feathers and say I was there to help with, you know, taking care of my stepdad, my pop. But that wouldn't be entirely true. I think at best what I can say is I was there to support my mom, who was taking care of him. She did all the work. I was there mostly to make sure, like almost as a glorified doorstop, a person who, if my mom needed 20 minutes to just leave the house and breathe, I could be there and make sure that he didn't die unnecessarily or fall or, you know, that sort of thing. I was also there as a sounding board for my mom. And I say that this time was a privilege because I got to watch the process of a thriving, larger-than-life human wither into something vulnerable, wither into death. I got to observe what's going to happen to me someday, maybe, hopefully, many years from now, but no one can be sure. And so the loss of my cat wasn't just about the loss of my cat. It was this realization, like, for example, as soon as I got home, I'm, you know, immediately removing the litter box, getting, you know, throwing out her food, getting everything out so I can just clean the space because I can't bear to look at it. And there's all these little things. And this is something I remember Brené Brown talking about, you know, people who discuss their grief. It's rarely the big kahuna moments that we grieve. It's most often the little things. The emptying of her litter box every day, the needing to wash my blankets more frequently because her little paws would track some of the kitty litter onto the comforter, the needing to vacuum the carpets more frequently. The way that if I tried to lay in bed and write in a journal, she would paw at my hand to get my attention. And I even remember multiple times as I'm journaling, I would put the pen down and I would look at her and I would think, one day I'm going to lose you. And I'm going to be so angry if the me that I'm remembering right now did not put down her pen and pet you. And I'm pleased to at least say that every time I had that thought, I put down my pen and I snuggled my cat. It's those things. It's like, I'm not a cat mom anymore. And it reminded me of the loss I felt when my stepdad passed. Because yes, of course, I miss him. I missed him then. I miss him now. But it wasn't just the loss of a human that I love. It was the loss of a whole life. He, my stepdad, represented a kind of stability I had never felt before. And he had steadied my mom in a way I'd never seen her steadied before. It was the loss of family. You know, I got to bond with his kids that he brought into the picture. And a lot of that faded with time. So it was more than just the loss of a person. It was the loss of a whole way of life. And I appreciate that, you know, David Kessler and Thomas More are pointing to that. They're not just talking about the loss of a person. And what they're also both pointing to is this idea that if you really want to heal, yes, you have to go through the stages of, you know, anger and bargaining and acceptance and all the things. But then there's this next level. And that's about finding meaning. So in the finding of meaning, this is now kind of bringing in work from, well, I don't want to say this was Sheryl Sandberg who discovered it, but she wrote about it in her book, Option B. And it's interesting because I read her first book, Lean In, and I had some ambivalence about it. I think a lot of people did, but I appreciated the contribution. But Option B was, it hit a little bit harder because her husband died. A man she loved, and so she had to navigate grief. She did a lot of work on resiliency, on what is it that helps culminate into post-traumatic growth as opposed to post-traumatic stress. And a lot of those things ended up being the very practices that lead people in general to more resilience in adversity. So really, then, the question becomes, how do we develop post-traumatic growth? How does that happen? And what the research points to is it can include a myriad of practices. Having a spiritual practice is a wildly powerful approach. there's research by, and unfortunately, I'm not remembering her name. I can put it in the notes, but she wrote a book called The Awakened Brain. And she revealed that those who have not only have a spiritual practice, but feel that spirituality is extremely important to them, their brains legitimately were wired differently. And those who then started to engage in a spiritual practice and cultivated more of a value around it had brains that started to mimic that. So it wasn't just correlation. It wasn't like, well, someone who has that kind of brain also, you know, they have a spiritual practice, but that they also have less depression. It was pretty clear the correlation was more causal. If you have this practice, you are less likely to have depression. And a spiritual practice does not have to necessarily mean a religious one. In my case, I was really moved by my practice in the study of the Yoga Sutras and this understanding of seeing life as being a part of a larger process of transcendence and, you know, independence. And I mean, that's a whole other episode. That's a whole other series of episodes on its own, but it doesn't have to be yoga therapy or Yoga Sutras for you. It could be connection to nature. It could be philosophy even. You know, interestingly, as it relates to philosophy, the Stoics, a group of people I happen to love naturally, they talk quite a bit about grief and even use grief as, well, a kind of tool. So their version of practicing gratitude, for example, which is another practice, evidence-based, known to help with post-traumatic growth. But their version looks like if you're petting your dog, imagining what it would be like to lose your dog and feel the pain of that and see what happens and how do you behave around your dog. If you're worried about losing your child, your husband, your, you know, whatever the thing is, and it does create this immense amount of gratitude for having it. Sometimes dress rehearsing loss. I mean, Brené Brown calls it dress rehearsing tragedy, but there can actually be value to it provided you're doing it strategically. So having a spiritual practice, which, or just being connected with something larger than yourself, connected to a larger philosophy, can be very helpful. Engaging in memories that are pleasant and like, especially if those memories can be shared, you know, if in my case, there were other people who knew me and who knew Sasha, and I got to share some of the silly little memories of her, just like how healing it was. I remember being at a more formal funeral for my stepdad and how in all funerals, there is this thing in common where people need to share stories of this person, of being witnessed in the sharing of their story, reaching out to help from others. I was not home when my poor cat died, and my one like incredible chosen family were kind enough to provide me with, let's say, a reframing. Because I was so guilty. I thought, God, I wasn't there. And they said, well, maybe she waited till you left to die. Maybe she knew. Maybe she didn't. But it's a lovely way to reframe. Having said that, if it had been me here, I mean, I would have just done the most pragmatic thing with her remains. I wouldn't have had the presence of mind, I don't think, to create a ritual. Perhaps I would have buried her. I don't know. But it was my cherished friend who has a cat herself and who loves that fur baby more than you could imagine. She's the one who said, no, I know what to do. I can get her cremated. I will get her, you know, get you a little paw print of like all, it did all of these things. It was my beloved partner and roommate who was tasked with figuring out how to get her body out of my room. And he's a very, very kind and sensitive being. So that was really hard on him. It was, even when I told my coworkers that I had asked, because it was as I was coming home, it happened the day before I was supposed to go back to work. And I'd ask if I could just have a few extra hours in the morning to take care of some of the extra logistics because my cat had died. And I was overwhelmed with gratitude because almost every person reached out to me, not just in the group, but individually saying, I'm so sorry. I know what it is to lose a pet. I was a wreck, which I think is so sweet. And it even reminded me. So when I was still living in California. I had just gotten Remy, my puppy. She was only 8 weeks old, that little ball of fluff. I'd never had a dog before, and I had fallen resolutely in love with this creature. And I'm beaming about it, and I'm exhausted because puppies are like babies in that they don't necessarily, they're not conducive to sleep. But a coworker of mine came in, and she's usually just this sunbeam of enthusiasm, and she seemed low. So I took a risk and asked her, you know, I'm just curious, are you okay? You look a little down. And she said, oh, you're so sweet. Yeah, actually, I had to put my dog down yesterday. And I just started to sob because I had only had that puppy, Remy, in my life for, what, a few weeks? And I had already grown so attached to her. And I just could imagine this person who had had a dog in her life for years. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And then, of course, she starts crying and then I start crying. And she's like, oh, thank you. You get it. And she then told me this story about how, you know, when she was taking her pup to the vet, because it was clear that her pup was just really suffering. And so she had to put, you know, go through the process of having the vet put her down to kill her. She said, and the last thing she did is lick my little face because she could tell I was sad. And I thought, oh God, woof, woof. But it was so beautiful and bittersweet. And I am most definitely a bittersweet type. So another thing then that can be tremendously helpful to create meaning out of loss is connection with other human beings, other people. We can reach out and say, I'm in a lot of pain. This is part of the reason why it's a pretty famous story, a Buddhist story. A woman loses her child and understandably is inconsolable. She wonders if it's possible that maybe the Buddha could help her. Might the Buddha be able to bring her child back to life? It's a long shot, but it's worth a try. She kneels before the Buddha and makes her request. And the Buddha says, I can help you. I will bring your child back to life. What I need is 6 mustard seeds. Might not have been 6, maybe it was 12. I don't know, but it was some number of mustard seeds. And she thinks to herself, okay, great. She goes off to get them. She says, wait. They must come from a household that has never experienced loss or death. Okay, she says, fine. So off she goes. Every door she knocks on, she's greeted by people who are tremendously kind and perfectly delighted to give her mustard seeds. But when she asks them, have you ever experienced loss? Has anyone that you love died? Every single one melted and said, oh, I'm so sorry, but yes. A grandmother, a mother, a sibling, a child, a pet. She eventually gives up and goes back to the Buddha and kneels before the Buddha and thanks the Buddha. She no longer needs her child to be revived. What she had really needed, what the Buddha already knew, was the realization that she was not alone. Her child was not going to come back because there was no person on the planet who would not experience loss. None of us gets out of this thing alive. So none of us is untouched by death. That is what alleviates her suffering. She's still in pain, but not in suffering. So she had meaning and connection with other people to help her. Another thing that can be helpful. So as I mentioned, you know, the idea of the implosion of grief becoming an explosion of compassion. That was The Dark Night of the Soul. So Thomas More. Thomas More also talks about how grief can become a boon of creativity. And this too is, I mean, dare I say it, evidence-based, a means that we can take to create meaning from our pain, creativity. Or I think it was Carrie Fisher who said, take your broken heart and turn it into art. We can also expose ourselves to nourishment, nourishing food, although often when we're grieving, we aren't necessarily very hungry, nourishing experiences, exposing ourselves to beauty. We can engage in movement. Often we want to just curl up into a ball, but so many of the emotions we feel with grief does whatever it wants to us. That was a quote by Elizabeth Gilbert. You know, it's not something that we can control. It does what it pleases. Sometimes just being in motion can be helpful. I know for me, long walks make a huge difference. And then finally, there is this very simple doing of nothing. Rest. That kind of brings me full circle, because again, the episode I most recently talked about, or my most recent episode that I, when I was talking about meaning, was how meaning and purpose can maybe morph into workaholism. If that's true, grief is one very potent antidote. At least it is for me. Grief absolutely reduces productivity. And in fact, it laughs at it. I had a coaching session with a young man who said, you know, it's odd because at the end of the day, I mean, I don't mean to sound cynical, but it's almost like everything's kind of meaningless. And he didn't mean it from a place of despair or hopelessness. He kind of meant it from a place of relief. You know, we spend so much time trying to, you know, what is the meaning of life and how can I live the best life? And it's like, yeah, but even if you live the best life, you're still going to die. You can't escape death by way of maximizing your productivity. Like, that's not how that works. There's a certain amount of relief that comes with that. Because, I mean, the bad news is, at the end of the day, I hate to break it to you, but nothing really matters. But the good news is, at the end of the day, nothing really matters. So this is it. This is where the whole be here now stuff comes from. There's value in simply pausing and realizing, oh, right, this is all going to be over. This is all going to end. Oof. And then exhale. Rest can be a very, very helpful bit of medicine in these periods. Slowing down, divorcing oneself from the idea that our value is wrapped up in what we produce. It's not to say that producing stuff isn't fun and lovely and doesn't provide us meaning. It's not that having purpose is bad. I've just dedicated a whole month to talking about purpose and meaning. But it's not everything. Rest and grief might be the yin to productivity's yang. So these are examples of things that perhaps might help you create more meaning out of your grief. I hope this was helpful for you if perhaps you've recently endured a loss, whether it was the loss of a person, a pet, or maybe it was the loss of something that wasn't, it was maybe less tangible, the loss of an identity, the loss of a job, the loss of something material. There's all kinds of losses that we might grieve. And if you should want to connect, just know you're always welcome, whether it's wanting to connect vis-a-vis a coaching session, wanting to connect to us on our in our online community. The links for all of that, of course, will be in the show notes. But for now, let me just say thank you for letting me share my grief with you. And let me just say that should you ever want to connect and share perhaps a bit of grief that you've experienced, you are most welcome. I would say have a wonderful evening. And maybe I mean that. Have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye.